Goddag og velkommen til Langsomme Samtaler. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Jeg har i den her uge talt med den amerikanske filosof Robert Pippin, som er en af de helt store læsere af den tyske idealisme, og især af Dagbladet Informations aktuelle yndlingsfilosof Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. Pippin er en af de store Hegel-fortolkere. Han har faktisk gennem de sidste 30-40 år fortolket, foldet ud, forstået Hegel, gjort Hegel påtrængende og relevant for samtiden, og forsikret os om, at der ikke er nogen problemer i verden, som man ikke bedst tilgår gennem Hegels tænkning. Og så er han alligevel kommet i tvivl. Det er faktisk det, hans nye bog The Culmination handler om. Lad mig lige indføre et par præmisser, som vil være hjælpsomme i samtalen, der ikke er filosofisk svært tilgængelig eller på nogen måde specielt akademisk indforstået, men der er et par præmisser, som er gode lige at få slået fast. Den ene er, Hegel, født i 1770, død i 1830, er modernitetsfilosof. Det vil sige, at hans filosofi handler om, hvordan de moderne samfund blev til. Hegel forstår det moderne samfund som konflikter. Konflikter mellem det, jeg føler, jeg bør gøre, min indre stemme, og mellem det, jeg rationelt godt kan se, er det fornuftige og det rigtige at gøre. Alle den type konflikter er Hegel utrolig god til at udpege, og ikke alene peger han på konflikterne i det moderne. Han insisterer også på, at det er konflikterne og vores måde at gå ind i og artikulere dem på, der driver det moderne fremad. Som Habermas sagde, Hegel er ikke den første moderne filosof, men han var den første filosof, der forstod det moderne som problem. Den næste ting, som er vigtig at forstå med Hegel, det er, at det er i al væsentlighed en frihedsfilosofi. Det vil sige, at det er en filosofi, der handler om, hvordan realiserer man friheden i historien. Frihed for Hegel er ikke, at jeg skal have lov til at gøre, hvad jeg har lyst til. Det er ikke hippiens frihed. Frihed er heller ikke, at jeg skal have ret til at gøre alt det, jeg har behov for at gøre, for at realisere mig selv. Det er heller ikke liberalistens frihed. Frihed for Hegel er, hvad for nogle institutioner, fælles åndelige rum, fælles forståelser og fornuftsrammer kan man skabe, så man kan få lov til at gøre, hvad man har lyst til, og så man kan gøre, hvad man har ret til. Altså, det er den sociale frihed, der garanterer muligheden for individuel selvrealisering, som Hegel er optaget af. Det er en af grundene til, at han er så utrolig interessant. Der sker så det i vores tid, at Hegels filosofi på en helt grundlæggende måde er udfordret. For det første, så naturforandringerne kan ikke rigtig rummes i Hegels filosofi. Hvis historien skulle kulminere i moderniteten, og modernitetens største udfordring er naturen, er kampen mod naturgrundlaget og klimaforandringerne, jamen hvor stiller det så Hegels filosofi overhovedet? Og for Hegel er moderniteten i al væsentlighed vestlig. Det er vores modernitet, som er målet for historien. Men hvad fanden stiller vi op, når Kina udvikler deres egen modernitet? Indien også har en anden form for modernitet. Skal vi så sige farvel og tak til Hegel, eller skal vi tilbage og se, hvordan den kan rumme det hele? Pippin er selv nået dertil, at han siger, at der er grænser for, hvad vi kan forstå med Hegel. Vi må også forstå moderniteten som noget større og mere end institutionelle konflikter, som vi kan bruge til at drive historien fremad. Vi må også forstå moderniteten som sammenbrud. Og derfor bevæger Pippin sig i sin seneste bog, The Culmination, over i den store modernitetskritiker Martin Heideggers værk. Det er et ret overraskende skridt at springe fra at studere Hegel hele sit liv, til så at konfrontere Hegel med Heidegger til sidst. Men det kommer der en god forklaring på. Og fordi det er så stort et spring, er det også en eksistentiel samtale. Det er en samtale, der handler om, man tror, man vokser op i en verden, der er styr på, og hvor der godt nok er kampe og konflikter, men de peger verden fremad. Og pludselig står man i en samtid og tænker, jamen de her konflikter, er det en eller anden form for undergang, vi er vidne til. Det er så meget, der er på spil i Pippins nye bog, og det er det, som vi folder ud i den her samtale. God fornøjelse.
Personally, I've been part of a Hegel society since I was 20.
No kidding.
That is right. That is right. We read the Master and the Bondsman when I was in high school. So, and yeah. You know, every time you reread Hegel, you need to start reinterpreting it. I find that. And your books have been new ways into Hegel and re-engaging with Hegel. That's been so helpful for us. Thank you for that.
Great, thank you. Yeah, no, I get, I mean, part of my career has been involved in defending a new ways into Hegel. I mean, the prominence when I started writing of the theological interpretation and the right-wing Hegelian interpretation was so pronounced that writing in American philosophy on Hegel was a little like writing on Madame Blavatsky or something. It was regarded as beneath the level of interest for Anglophone philosophers. And in the last 40 years, that has changed dramatically. I'm very, very happy about that. It's been very nice to live through this period where he sort of reemerged, especially in the Anglophone world, as somebody worth taking seriously.
I think we find that here as well. But I want to ask you first, because there's such an inspiration and curiosity in your occupation with German philosophy that's been going on for decades now. So I'm curious, how was your original encounter with philosophy and maybe even German philosophy in particular?
Well, I don't know how far back you want to go, but when I was in college, I was not, as we say in the States, a philosophy major. I didn't concentrate in philosophy. I concentrated in American and modern European literature. I was actually planning to be a novelist, but people started criticizing my fiction for being way too philosophical. And I started to realize that the questions that interested me were in literature, but the philosophical classics seemed to me a better vehicle for raising the questions I wanted to raise. So I started taking philosophy courses, and I was just blown away by, first of all, by Kant. And then I realized that some of the limitations I thought were present in Kant's philosophy, especially in his moral philosophy, required that I take a long time to have a serious engagement with Hegel. I wrote my dissertation in graduate school on Kant because, well, for two reasons. One, Kant was effectively the end of the metaphysical tradition, the end of the aspiration for a priori reason to know the really real nature of reality. And so that kind of ended with Kant, in effect. I mean, there's still metaphysicians around, but the grand tradition of metaphysics from Plato through Leibniz did seem to come to an end with Kant, and because of him. And then secondly, the distinctness of human being had always been, for 2,000 years of the tradition, a matter of a special kind of substance. And since Kant had ended the metaphysical tradition, that wasn't available to him to distinguish human beings as free agents from natural objects. And Kant pioneered a way of thinking about human beings that didn't require some commitment to a particular kind of substance. And that seemed to me extremely interesting and present in Hegel as well. Although, again, I think the traditional Hegel interpretation relocated him back in the metaphysical tradition. But I thought the way to really present Hegel as a modern thinker was to realize how deeply he appreciated Kant's critique of rationalist metaphysics on the one hand, and then Kant's initiation of a new way of thinking about human being non-substantially and as an agent without metaphysical presuppositions on the other hand. So that became a kind of defining moment in my career, and I wrote from the time of the Kant book to 1989, those 8 years, I worked on Hegel's idealism. And that found an audience. I found that to be receptive. And then because of the work on Hegel, I became interested in the modalities of philosophy other than discursive analysis. I started to get very interested in art because I was very inspired by Hegel's lectures on the philosophy of fine art. And that led to a whole set of different issues, mostly revolving around literature, film, and the visual arts. So it started with Kant, a kind of interest in philosophy that arose out of literature. And then once I realized how fantastically effective Kant had been in shifting the entire metaphysical tradition to something new, it seemed to me more profitable to work on Hegel than the neo-Kantian and then analytic derivations from Kant that really kind of restricted philosophy, whereas Hegel expanded the realm of what philosophy could be about.
I think for many of us here, Søren Kierkegaard is the natural way to Hegel because we're Danish. And, you know, and for a long time when you're young, you think that Søren Kierkegaard is the superior and that Hegel is this clown who built a whole mansion and there wasn't room for himself, so he had to live in the dog's house.
Yeah,
and then you start studying Hegel and you realize, well, maybe it's not so simple after all. And then there is another way to Hegel here, which goes through the lectures of Khrushchev. That was very, very influential for a generation of French thinkers. For me personally, it was Charles Taylor. His great book on on Hegel was when I really understood this tension between the heart and the and reasoning. And I understood modernity is about conflict. It's not about principle. It's defining conflict. So that was for me the that blew my mind, actually. Yeah. Charles Taylor's book. We had him on the podcast. That was a big moment for me. Were there any specific interpretations of Hegel that was particularly inspirational to you?
Kozhev. When I was in graduate school, I had the same reaction. This was the introduction to the reading of Hegel was such an exciting book. The thing that really impressed me about Taylor's book was, there's a whole side of it that I, strongly disagree with.
I know.
Metaphysical, cosmic spirit, the theological metaphysics that cosmic spirit metaphysics that Taylor defended. But there are two things about that book that really I thought were inspiring. One was his taking quite seriously Hegel's claim that philosophy should be about its own time, comprehended in thought, that at the center of Hegel's philosophical enterprise, not as a sidelight, was a theory of modernity. And as you say, a theory of the unreconciled tensions in modernity. And that seemed to me correspond exactly to especially the early Hegel's intuition in his Differenzschrift when he's writing about Fichte and Schelling. He said that the beginning of philosophy is zerrissenheit, is torn apartness. And Taylor really did a very good job of convincing people that there was something right about locating at the center of Hegel the theory of modernity. And then the second one was Taylor's dissatisfaction with the limitations, in a way, the kind of spiritual limitations of liberal individualism. Taylor, since he was so involved in Canadian politics and in the building of a kind of Quebecois community in Montreal, he wanted to defend an idea of social dependence that was really the beginning in a lot of ways of what we used to call communitarianism and a variety of ways of criticizing liberal individualism. And that seemed to be quite right. I mean, just as philosophy is its own time comprehended in thought, the other beautiful Hegelian idea is that no one is free unless everyone is free. That it's necessary to think of freedom as a collective social enterprise rather than the freedom from external constraint on the part of atomistic individuals. So those two elements of Taylor's book, I agree, were quite revolutionary. And because Taylor was an Oxford Don when he wrote the book, and he had done extremely distinguished work in philosophy before, he couldn't be dismissed as one of these minor provincial philosophers who occasionally works on these odd figures. He was a very serious and important Anglophone philosopher. So people started to think, well, if Chuck Taylor can think of this stuff as worth reading and taking seriously, maybe I should. So that helped a great deal in legitimizing the study of Hegel in Anglophone philosophy. I agree with you. It's a very important book.
And something that struck me also as a young man was something that you've been exploring in a very impressive way, namely individuality in Hegel, because I grew up in the 70s and probably the most liberal decade in one of the most liberal countries in the world. Yeah. And it was all about individuality at the time and self-realization, but it was individuality understood as something that was always already given, something that was almost an empirical fact that it was there. But I realized that it's a lot more complex in Hegel. Individuality is something quite distinct. What brought you to this part of Hegel's philosophy?
Well, I was a 68er. I was a sophomore in college in 68. So that was my formative experiences were the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, and, collective attempts to create political will to change things. And it just seemed to me that Hegel had the right way of understanding the nature of social dependence, that the boundaries of the individual, especially with this account of a collective mindedness, that we all inherit a collective mindedness and can't presume a kind of autonomous self-sufficiency, and that we had to really think through this dependency in a more serious way. Because Geist, for me, was not, given the kind of left Hegelian reading of Hegel, it wasn't really a substantive metaphysical entity. It was a mode of collective mindedness that had a history, and the history had a kind of dynamic that Hegel thought he could understand. So it just struck me out of the experience, the experience of attempting to form collectivities during the 60s, which was really concentrated on community organizing and a view of the non-isolatability of individual preferences, desires, romantic dreams, and so forth, that seemed to me to require a study of the social dimensions of individuality, we could call it.
I think there's a very big difference between the left and the 60s in the US and here in Northern Europe, because you had the civil rights movement. So there was always this understanding that the realization of the individual would require the realization of a collective. And also this understanding that there's a part of the normativity that I require to be free that can appeal to everyone. I think that is actually quite a big difference, because we were more here on the material level. Our 60s were more based on that. So a figure like Bernie Sanders would be unthinkable. Here we would have Corbyn instead, and I absolutely prefer Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, well, the other dimension of this is my experience with Germany, because I've been going to and living in Germany for 50 years now. And in the 70s, the main reaction in Germany to the sort of social conflicts of the age was rage, was incredible anger. It was kind of fueled by the what you did in the war, Daddy, kind of recovery of some memory. And a refusal to bury any longer their Nazi past. But there was also, I think throughout France and Italy and Germany, there was just tremendous anger at the way in which any form of individuality clearly relied on enormous regimes of repression and oppression and inequality and kind of unthinking complacency about scientism and eventually about the environment and so forth. So the other experience, I think, besides the two we've been talking about, is this upsurge of anger against the thoughtlessness and closed-mindedness, the bourgeois smugness of European society after this period of great prosperity in the 50s and 60s when the post-war economies of the West boomed. There was finally this moment when young people finally said that this mindless consumerism is killing us. And that rage was another element in the 60s and 70s that is a little harder to accommodate to Hegel, because he was more of a reconciliationist kind of philosopher and a defender of bourgeois society. But the bourgeois society he was defending was a very different one that emerged in the 70s in Europe.
Growing up or being part of 68, of course, also came with some notions of freedom, because freedom was at the center of it. Then, and I think it's fair to say, it's in your work as well, that Hegel is ultimately, his philosophy of history is ultimately a philosophy of freedom. Freedom is at the core of it. He has a unique understanding of freedom. But did that reading and studying and investigating Hegel, did that change your own conception of freedom?
Yeah, as I said, the alternatives here were Kant on the one hand, a kind of autonomous, rational individual, and Hegel on the other hand, in which for Kant, the classical conception of freedom, the modern conception, the one threatened by modern natural science, was how can we create a space for something like spontaneous causality, that we can be the initiators of actions which turn out to be bodily movements in space, even though bodily movements in space are entirely predictable by natural science. So Kant had formulated a problem that we still inherit as the problem of free will and whether or not there is such a thing as free will. And as I was saying before, Kant tried to invent a way of accounting for that possibility without a substantialist metaphysics, a kind of an idealism that argued we can't know whether we are or we're not, but we have a kind of practical necessity to think of ourselves as free. Hegel rejected that whole approach and rejects the whole approach of trying to carve out a metaphysical space for uncaused causality. Hegel's conception of freedom is not that I can view myself as the causal source of the activities that I engage in, but that the activities I engage in somehow can be experienced by me as my own. And they're not necessarily experienced by me as my own that reflect me back to me and what I see myself having to do just because I voluntarily do it. There are many people who labor in factories and on farms, and they do what they do willingly and voluntarily, but they don't see their lives as reflections of them, of what they would do were they not constrained by economic and social conditions and so forth. So this idea of freedom as self-realization socially, of there being a form of society in which people's roles actually correspond to how they think of themselves, the best parts of themselves, the rational parts of themselves, but with a completely different conception of reason than Kant's formal notion of rationality. So the idea that freedom shouldn't be understood as trying to prove that we're causally responsible for all the activities we create, but that the activities we create are actually our own, that the preferences we have and the activities we engage in are not the distilled products of an ideological machine that creates people who have certain kind of interests and activities that are compatible with the machine. Hegel wanted a form of social life in which the activities of people, cooperative and dependent activities on each other, nevertheless could be experienced as genuinely my own, that reflect me back to me. And that seemed to be a much better, because the free will problem is essentially unsolvable in philosophy. That leads one to suspect that the problem is badly posed, that there's something wrong with the problem itself. And I think that's basically the issue, that this causal voluntarist could have done otherwise conception of freedom versus this self-realization socially, social roles that reflect the dimensions of human being that can inspire mutuality of recognition, mutuality of respect. And that's what we don't have in contemporary capitalist societies, are positions of authority and work that inspire or allow mutual respect. The positions that people have to occupy are often humiliating and debased, and even though they're all voluntary, I mean, the structure within which they have to operate actually doesn't allow them any kind of space for anything other than what the actual demands of profit and efficiency require.
When we read Hegel, and you mentioned the concept of Zerrissenheit before, and I remember when I was young and I've read Vorrede, and there's this line, man muss sich in der absoluten Zerrissenheit befinden, then you feel that it's almost written 5 minutes ago, that it's so contemporary. When he reads about the beautiful soul, you know, we speak about that with the climate activists all the time, that you cannot become a beautiful soul. That will not help you. Then it's so contemporary. And it's like he was just advising us. Then we have these metaphysical concepts, like, of course, most prominently, Geist, spirit. And when I try to explain spirit to people, they look at me as if I'm speaking from another age. You've written a lot about how to translate, especially this concept, Geist. How should we? Because it's so central. It's so central to what we're part of. How should we, in your view, translate that into our modern context?
Well, I think since going back to the idea of kind of a collected mindedness, the key understanding and really the core of what people call Hegel's dialectic is to understand this collective mindedness as, on the one hand, nothing other but the result of the commitments of individuals that form a kind of collective enterprise. However, on the other hand, the individuals who form the collective enterprise are themselves products of, distillations of, inherit the predominant collectivity of the age they live in. So that the idea that there's what we call sociality is nothing but the product of individual attitudes. And on the other hand, the idea that individual attitudes are nothing but the distillation of a kind of fixed social enterprise that just manifests itself in individuals, that both of those positions are wrong. And that the way to think about it is to have a form of thought in which we can think of them as mutually reinforcing each other and not an alternative, that we're either, you know, products of society or that society is nothing but a product of individuals. I think the key idea in Geist is the idea of this collective enterprise that can't be regarded as either the product of individuals or the dominating force that creates individuals.
And of course, when we read Hegel, we think of Geist as singular, that there's this one Geist in history. And it is also a theory of modernization, Western modernization. And sometimes looking at the world today, you look at China, you say, I think at least their modernity is somewhat different from ours. They have a different conception of the individual. They have a different conception of the tensions between the individual and the collective than those that we saw in Taylor, for instance. And that, to a certain extent, begs the question whether we should think of one Geist or several Geists at the same time, or maybe we haven't reached the point in history where we could see it was the same Geist. Do you understand the question?
Yeah. I, well, on the one hand, it is true that Hegel's focus is on basically the Western inheritance of Greek rationalism and Christianity. So he does have a definitely Eurocentric focus on modernization. That's essentially, I think, most of what he has to say in his lectures on the philosophy of history about other cultures is compared with even people like Leibniz or Montesquieu, pretty uninformed. But the thing that I think is quite interesting about modernization and the idea of alternate modernities in Japan or China or Southeast Asia or Africa is the role of technology and science in creating a kind of Weberian bureaucratic state, a kind of normalizing, standardizing, homogenizing, Europeanist kind of technical control that I think eventually is already crushing out any kind of remnant of the cultural inheritance that is still visible from pre-modernity, from the pre-scientization and technification of society. But I think once bureaucratic modes of efficiency are accepted and scientific and technological priorities are established as the only legitimate cognitive authority and so forth, I think there's a kind of homogenization of culture as a result of, because, you know, China and Japan are now capitalist countries. And as capitalist countries, they have the same kind of problems with profit, efficiency, and the necessary arrangement of society to ensure profit and sufficiency. So I'm not sure these various cultural differences will eventually, I mean, I think they should, but I don't think they'll survive the process of economic modernization, because that's not isolatable. That comes with an enormous number of other changes in a society in order for there to be a competitive country working in a world economy.
But going back to Taylor again, he would say that it's constituent for us that we consider, in some domains of life, we consider the heart the highest authority, or what's called the sentiment de cœur in Rousseau, that there is this always appealing to our individual tribunal, you could almost say. And I'm not quite sure we see that the same way, even though we see the same efficiency, the same vehicles of capitalism, the same bureaucracy, but I'm not quite sure we see the same ethical principles at stake here. How do you see this?
Well, somewhat differently. I think the demands of an international participation in the global capitalist economy requires certain traits of character, like ruthlessness, hard-heartedness, efficiency. The demands of even in an authoritarian capitalist system like China, the companies have to succeed. They have to organize a workforce in ways that will eventually produce, I think, different kinds of souls. I grant that there are vast cultural differences in how the Japanese or the Chinese think of each other and the way we do. But the way they live is so saturated with consumerism, especially in Japan, that I don't see any, the fact that, you know, you have to have a Shinto priest to open a McDonald's, it doesn't strike me as, you know, kind of world historically significant. They're still building McDonald's, you know, just, and the people are still visiting them, and they don't really care about whether the Shinto priest has blessed it or not. One more thing about Taylor, you know, he has a new big 600-page book coming out called Cosmic Connections, which is an attempt to actually appeal to poetry. He's got readings of several poets that are is meant to carve out this space to show that the Romantic movement in the 19th century was not just a kind of moment of protest against what these poets and artists saw emerging as a homogenized, dead, spiritless capitalist culture, but that they serve as permanent alternatives, ways of feeling and thinking that still have a bearing today. So that book comes out this month, or next month, I can't remember which. I've agreed to review it for a journal. So I'm quite interested in read, because I have a great interest in the domain of art as a kind of sanctuary and criticism of a way of recovering some of the things that the social form of capitalism requires of individuals.
Yeah, I love what you write about Heidegger and poetry near the end of The Culmination, because Heidegger sees the same things no matter what poetry he reads. You know, he's not like this great. It's not like, oh, let's find this unhidden, this Unverborgenheit, this opening. The opening always reveals the same. I love that part. I wanted to ask you the same question, but from another angle, which strikes me as important today. I have a lot of young people coming here, and when I say, well, we should read Hegel, we should understand the complexities of our time through Hegel, there's a big conceptual framework here that will help you and also make you understand you cannot solve the world through theories. If you're very, very lucky, you can conceptualize what's already there, but no theories can give you political solutions. I'm sorry to say. Well, then they say, well, Hegel is a white man's philosophy. It's the part of the colonial heritage. And I say, well, look at Frantz Fanon, you know? He turned it against it. He said, well, here's black man's Hegel. He turned it against the European colonialists. But they say, well, it's still within this framework. And of course, you can find these aspects in Hegel. Like you said before, his reading of Asia is not impressive, of Africa neither. Do you think that he's within a Western worldview, or do you think he's able to transcend it?
Well, that's actually extremely difficult question, because Hegel still is inspired by the connection between freedom and rationality. And that means some conception of the way we ought to live, still in Hegel, although he has a very different conception of reason than, say, Kant or Spinoza. Nevertheless, Hegel is still part of a tradition that insists that practices should be subject to some sort of self-conscious reflective legitimacy. And that leads to the question of whether it's right for us to either accept or reject practices in other countries that we can find no legitimate way to justify, particularly the treatment of women and the treatment of children. The kind of totalization of this consideration of the West as nothing but a colonial power confuses two different questions. One is the obligation we have to consider reflectively what we think of practices that our intuitions and our reflective capacities tell us are unjust. And the other is whether that entitles us to do anything to them.
Yes.
And there's no connection there. We can certainly think that, throwing widows on the funeral pyre is a horrible, horrible practice, but it doesn't mean we are by that alone entitled to march in and change it. That's a crazy idea. So it's true that the old colonialist notion of the superiority of the West was used to support a brutal expropriation of other people's stuff. But that doesn't mean that we're sort of exempt in a kind of radical pluralism from simply not thinking about the consequences of practices that we regard as abhorrent. Genital mutilation, the subjection of women, the exclusion of women from the public sphere, gender-based division of labor. So the people who say, well, all of those are just Western ideas, and we have no right to think of them as superior. Well, we have a right to think. we can't stop thinking by virtue of just the fact that there are other practices that come out of other traditions. But I think the mistake is thinking, as the colonialists did, that entitles us to expropriate other people and tell them what to do. It certainly doesn't. And Hegel was wrong to think that. Kant, for example, was anti-colonialist. He didn't think we had any right to march in and take over countries, but he did think that the inheritance of Christian moralism, essentially his secular theory of morality, was a superior theory of how we ought to live. But he tried to defend that. He didn't just, broadcast it as a kind of religious doctrine or something you just had to believe. And I think we're in the same position. We don't want to be colonial powers. We don't want to assume that what we regard as our own way of reflectively justifying our lives entitles us to do anything to other people, but we can't stop thinking about, how essentially we ought to live. And that doesn't mean a theory. That means something like a reflective attention to the way we live now and whether it has in it contradictions, inconsistencies, unfairness in a way that can't be justified. The sort of concrete approach to the problems of social life that Hegel pioneered seems to me still quite relevant.
I want to turn to your new book, your very, very good new book, The Culmination, because we also had a Heidegger Society when I was young. But we, you know, 10 years ago, we said, well, his theory, this decline, viewing modernity as just decline, his view on science as just, it doesn't think, it's just too arrogant. And he doesn't have any understanding for what he doesn't understand. But sometimes today, I think that the criticism of modernity, even though I don't like the elements of it, has a right core in it. That maybe, you know, there's something to this saying, we shall not be the masters of being understood as science. We should be the shepherds of science, of being, meaning science. And I was wondering whether when you take up Heidegger against Hegel, as you do here, whether it's also because you changed your own interpretation of modernity or what modernity has become today. I know this is a large question.
Yeah, it's a very, very big question. I mean, so the first step is acknowledging, for all of the many, many ways Hegel still has a lot to contribute to modern philosophy, modern conceptions of art, modern conceptions of religion and historical development and so forth. Hegel's understanding of the emergence of the modern world in the 1820s, essentially, when he was lecturing on the philosophy of right and developing his ideas about modern ethical life, Sittlichkeit, was an extremely limited perspective. The market capitalism that he saw emerging was not mass industrial capitalism. It was small business, small farm, small owner proprietor businesses, with limited international trade. He could see what was coming in England. He could see industrialization and urbanization as, in a way, inevitable elements of modernity. But he didn't really appreciate how differently, or one could even say catastrophically, the emergence of a modern global capitalist consumer society culture would make many of the ways in which he wanted to defend the social roles available in the family, in civil society, and in the state. It couldn't really appreciate how much the change in the late 19th century, essentially, and how much the catastrophic effects of World War I and World War II would mean that our analysis of the sort of legacy of Greek rationalism, Christianity, liberal individualism, and democratic institutions would look completely different in the 20th century. And I became convinced that there was just something quite limited, not only about the details of Hegel's conception of ethical life, that it was way too narrow and had not appreciated the pathologies of bourgeois life that would emerge in the 20th century, but that there might be something wrong with the way he approached the problem, that there was still this inheritance on the power of a certain conception of reason to redeem the way we live, to identify the Spuren der Vernunft, the traces of reason in modern society. And critical theory Marxism in the 20s and 30s in Germany, it had the same kind of aspiration to try to demonstrate how we were creating the conditions of our own self-overcoming. And I became less and less convinced that we were doing that, that the pathologies of modern society were becoming much more serious than anything Hegel could have anticipated, and that we did not have within them the internal dialectic that was the sort of germ of Hegel's optimism about the future of Western bourgeois society. And it was still present in even people like Adorno and Marcuse and Habermas and people like that, that there was a way of thinking about the pathologies and the catastrophe that also showed a way out of them. I'm not sure that we have any way out of them anymore. And that means you turn to somebody like Heidegger, who thinks, no, the issues are much more fundamental. They have to do, I mean, this is an implausible view, that the difficulties of late capitalist society should be understood as due to the forgetting of the meaning of being.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we tend to think of the basic steering mechanisms of society as politics, technology, science, health policy, and so forth. But if you ask yourself, Under what assumptions does a way of life like capitalism emerge? Is it all that implausible to think that the assumption of the meaning of being is just present at hand materiality, as inherited, if it really is inherited, from the Platonic and Aristotelian beginnings of the understanding of rational enlightenment, that this deep orientation towards what it means, how things show up for us in their significance, is limited to their mere presence as objects in space and time? If we think that, then everything else becomes subjective, and everything else becomes subjective and arbitrary, and that's what Heidegger calls nihilism. So that this way of cutting ourselves off from different ways of thinking about meaningfulness in the availability of beings, Heidegger, I think I became really interested in the idea that this had something to do with the kind of hopelessness of opposing capitalism, science, the pollution of the environment, climate catastrophe, and so forth. Why has all that occurred? What assumptions are the original manifestation of reality that we take to be the real and we take to be significant in only this sense as knowable, as discursively knowable, might be responsible for that? I became convinced of that, just given how bad things have gotten, how hopeless things are.
But yeah, and to me, that is existentially surprising, you know, to reach a point in the history where, when I was growing up in the 70s, you know, I loved, you know, the theories of Adorno, because they were, it's something that you like to say as a young man, because they're so radical and you can throw away everything with them. Say, it's the non-identical, it's the non-identical. You know, it gives you slogans to reject the world. But then I read Habermas and I thought, well, he's right. This is how we should engage, also because I don't like the communitarian strand of Charles Taylor. I prefer that part of Habermas. But existentially, it is surprising to be at a point where you think that maybe there is something in Heidegger that is right, that there is, that what mattered in the metaphysical tradition, what mattered was not all that mattered after all. And so then, so there's a forgetting of being. Do you buy that?
Yeah, I mean, this depends on one's interpretation of Heidegger. And in the book, I'm trying to defend a unity of Heidegger's thought in which the availability of being at its most fundamental level is an issue of it mattering, of Bedeutsamkeit, of its essential significance, in which the emergence of significance is not a matter of cognition, but a matter of what Heidegger called attunement or Stimmung. This goes back a little bit to the issues in Taylor and Romanticism we were talking about before, that there are modes of fundamental relationships to the world and to each other that are not basically derivative from cognition, from discursive propositional knowledge, that we tend to think that anything other than that is just subjective. It's just a projection of subjective preferences and desires onto the world. That way of thinking seems to me catastrophic, that there is a way of appreciating a kind of commonness in the human attunement to what matters in the world that we've taken to be just a matter of individual preferences, whereas that itself is an inheritance of a common world of mattering that we are thoughtless about, that we just take for granted. So Heidegger's main sort of enterprise is not to give us a new meaning of being, but to wake us up, to forgetfulness. And that doesn't, I mean, that you see this in Hannah Arendt too, the main, I don't agree with her Eichmann book, but the idea that the problem is not a kind of stupidity or greed or but thoughtlessness. That's the Heideggerian thought that Arendt inherited and did something quite interesting with. And I think that kind of pathology, this unreflective assumption of the meaning of being as knowability, as the primary mode of relationship to the world, as cognition, everything else following from that or being merely subjective, is a disastrous way of thinking. First of all, it makes art nothing but amusement, entertainment, something that we just, you know, when our work is done, that we entertain ourselves with, or that we explain neurologically, evolutionarily, you know, sociologically, and we've lost the capacity to even appreciate the power of the aesthetic.
Along with Heidegger, you could say that, you know, for him, every time you disclose something, you hide something as well. That's the hermeneutic of Heidegger. So metaphysics discloses something and hides something. And you could say that at this moment we're in now, there's something hopeful about the catastrophe that actually discloses something. But then, that is the hopeful thing that I sometimes think. Then I look at the sun and I look at the wind and I look at nature, and it's like, this is an extension of modernity, this extension of what Heidegger criticized. It's all just becoming sources of energy. That now we're in this green transition, and it's just everything should be transformed into sources of energy. How do you see this? I know this is the last question. I know it's a big question, but I'm very curious about how you see this.
Well, somewhat the same way you do. I mean, I think we need to think about why is fundamentally the way we've approached nature so irresistible to us. The number of farmers has been reduced by, I don't know, something like 300%, and the yield has gone up by 150%. I mean, because of technology, fertilizer, modern production methods, and so forth, factory farming of animals. There's just enormous amount of the use of fossil fuel, the problem of the developing world's need to rely on coal and sources of energy that are polluting and so forth. Why does all this seem so irresistible? Because there is a kind of economic imperative that if we don't continue to live this way, we won't live well, which assumes that we know what we're about in trying to live well. So I think the issue of the world's historical power, of this whole framework of exploitation, material for use, technological imperatives that we find irresistible. You could think of it as a kind of psychological question, but I think Heidegger's approach existentially is much deeper, that there's something going wrong in the way we're thinking about something fundamental if we can't collectively muster the energy to stop this, or the collective will formation to stop it, and even to deny that it's happening. That's crazy. And to live in a situation of that kind of insanity, I think, prompts us to think deeper about how we've gotten into this insanity. And I do think Heidegger has something to say about what we've forgotten, that this whole image of a kind of thoughtless forgetting of the problem of significance mattering is a way to begin thinking about why we're in this mess in the first place.
Well, thank you so much. Your book is very helpful when it comes to that. And this conversation was just a delight and a privilege to me. Thank you so much for taking your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I enjoyed talking with you. It's very, very interesting to hear what's going on in Copenhagen.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Det var min samtale med vores ven Robert Pippin, som er professor i filosofi ved University of Chicago. Samtalen var sat sammen og redigeret af vores helt vidunderlige ven og hjælper Albert Kuhlmann. I næste uge skal vi tale med en ny stjerneøkonom, Isabel M. Weber, der har skrevet en helt formidabel bog om, hvordan det kinesiske kommunistparti valgte den økonomiske politik, der har gjort dem til det mest økonomisk succesrige politiske eksperiment i det sidste halve århundrede. Isabella M. Weber har talt med dem, der designede politikken i 80'erne. Hun har lavet research og interviews med dem, der var der, og har således været inde i hjernen på det kinesiske kommunistparti i 1980'erne. Det har hun skrevet en helt utrolig god bog om, og den kommer vi til at tale om i næste uge. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Tusind tak for, at I lyttede med, og bliver ved med at følge os i kampene for og imod moderniteten ind og ud af Hegel. Og må ikke også, vi ender der på et eller andet tidspunkt igen. Det tror jeg på.